So maybe you've seen, like on the Discovery Channel or National Geographic, or maybe you remember from your elementary school days learning about spiders. But when a spider spins a web, the very first thing it does is drop that first line. And as magnificent and as large and as beautiful as the web may be, it's all dependent upon that one thread, that first thread that is spun. And if you cut that thread, it doesn't matter how much work the spider has done, the web is no more. The whole law and the prophets depend on these two commandments. Everything hangs in the balance on how well we respond to these two great commandments. Nothing else matters. Without these two, doesn't matter how beautiful your life is, how complete, how full it is. If you don't love God above all things with your whole heart, mind, soul, and strength, and your neighbor as yourself, you have nothing. For the last few weeks, we've been entering into this dialogue, this sparring back and forth between Jesus and the religious leaders. And no matter how many times they try, Jesus always prevails. He's doing this as an act of love towards them. Even with those threats of taking the kingdom away from them and kicking them out into the wailing and grinding of teeth into the darkness of night, it's all an act of love, this last-ditch effort to get them to understand what's at stake if they continue to reject him and his teachings and his new way of life. He silenced the Sadducees. We didn't get that part last week, and they skipped it before this week. But the Sadducees were a group of people who didn't believe in life after death. They didn't believe in the resurrection. So they were trying to trip him up and trap him by asking him a question about resurrection and life after death. And he was able to silence them. And so here they come again, trying to figure out. Because as we hopefully know, there were 613 laws in the Old Testament. 613 commandments that they were expected to follow. And so you can imagine that there was probably a constant conversation, which is the greatest, which is the most important. You know, maybe some practical ones, and then the intellectual elite getting together and talking amongst themselves. This still happens in the church today, where church leaders will come together and just talk amongst themselves with no real application to the lives. It's an intellectual pursuit and not a changing of the heart. But it does make sense. I mean, just think about, especially those of you raising children or who have raised children, how many things do you have to get done every day in your own life and then in your children's lives? Or maybe you're taking care of your parents now. There's so many things to get done. Like, what's the most important? What's the principle that if you don't get this thing done, then nothing else the rest of the day will even matter? This is at the heart of this question about the greatest commandment. What is the foundational principle? What is the first thing that makes sense of every other thing? Because if they could get Jesus to say the wrong thing, and then they could just dismiss him and excuse him, and he's no part of our lives. We don't need him. He's chosen the wrong one. But he goes to the heart. Back to Deuteronomy chapter 6, the Shema. A great prayer of the Jewish people. Much like the Our Father is the crux of our central prayer life, the Shema was for the Jewish people. They would pray it multiple times a day. The Lord is one, the Lord alone. And you shall love him with your whole heart, mind, soul, and strength. And then that instruction tells the parents to drill it into their hearts of their children, to inculcate their children with the reality that God is one and he's deserving of everything. And then love your neighbor as yourself. I think in our modern culture, we're more willing to accept that second commandment than the first one. Especially in our progressive, agenda-driven culture, where love can be redefined on a moment's basis. So love my neighbor is fine. I can do whatever, basically anything I want to do and call it love. Right? Love is love. As Westerners, we buy into this nonsense. Jesus tells us in John chapter 17 that eternal life means that we know God. That this is eternal life, that they know you, the one true God. To know God means eternal life. And he says that word knowledge the same way that a husband knows his wife and then they procreate children, the intimacy that's required to know God. So it can't be just whatever we want it to be. It's very specific. And St. John of the Cross, a great Carmelite mystic, says at the end of our life, we're judged by love alone. So if that is true, it seems like we should have a clear idea of what it means to love. To love God with your whole heart, mind, soul, and strength. Do you? Is God your first thing, your only thing? Is he your foundational principle in every decision that you make? St. Paul reminds us that part of the effect of sin is a darkened intellect. So when we're commanded to love God with our whole mind, we can't just rely on our understanding and what makes sense to us. This knowledge of God is a gift bestowed upon us. And that as we pursue him, we get to know him more. And then the more we know about God, the more we want to love him. Again, we can look at human relationships. We all have this experience. You can't love someone that you don't know. You might have a crush on them. You might be infatuated with them, but you don't love them. But once you meet that person, and the butterflies come and googly eyes come, and you there's an attraction there, but then you want to know more about them, so that you can love them more perfectly. It would be kind of silly if a husband didn't know his wife's favorite color, if a wife doesn't know her husband's middle name, or what street he grew up on, or who was his best friend in middle school. Can we say there's a true love there? This knowledge, this desiring to know more and more and more, this is what it means to love God. And so how often do we settle for what we learned about God in eighth grade or third grade? How often do we allow the world to tell us what it means to love and who God is and what's important in our faith life? A husband and a wife must change lots about their lives if they're going to be committed to each other. And hopefully it's not a drudgery. Hopefully it's done with enthusiasm and joy. But it does require suffering. It does require sacrifice. And our modern notion of love has taken suffering completely out. Our idea of God is completely absent from that. Some sociologists a few years back did a longitudinal study, a multi-year study over many Christian faiths, traditions. And what most people believe when they say they believe in God is not the God of the scriptures, not God revealed to us through the Roman Catholic Church. But they came up with this term of moralistic therapeutic deism as a substitute for the living God of the scriptures. That God just is moralistic. He just wants us to be good, be nice, be tolerant, be woke, therapeutic. He's going to make you feel good. Happy, happy, joy, joy. And then a deistic view of God, which is very much what the founders of our country had. That God exists, he's real, but he kind of set things in motion and he excused himself. He's not involved in the daily life of his creatures, which gives us the freedom to do whatever we want, and then we can create him in our own image versus realizing that we are in his image. And from last week, we give to God what belongs to God. It's the same thing as to love him with your whole heart, mind, soul, and strength. And so do we. Do we know God? And do you love him? What's the first thing you do when you wake up in the morning? You offer a prayer of thanksgiving and gratitude? Or do you just reach for your phone and check your emails and scroll through your social media? When something good happens, do you turn with a prayer of thanksgiving? When something bad happens, do you turn with a prayer of thanksgiving? How necessary is God in your daily life? If the Pope came out and said, ha ha, just kidding, all this stuff is for nothing, we've just been joking this whole time, would your life change? Would you notice anything different in your life if all of this was for show? Or would your spider web be destroyed? Because the one thing, the only thing, is no more. In this beautiful letter that we're hearing in the second reading from St. Paul to the church of Thessalonica, you know what sort of people we were among you, and you became imitators of us and of the Lord. That these pagan people who were worshiping idols and other gods encountered St. Paul, and Acts of the Apostles says he was probably there for only 3 weeks. The most powerful 3 weeks of these people's lives. They encountered St. Paul, and through St. Paul encountered Jesus Christ and his gospel. They became imitators of me and of the Lord, receiving the word in great affliction, but with joy. Affliction with joy. Our common culture won't let those two words coexist, but they're at the heart of the gospel. You became a model for all those who trust in Jesus Christ. And through your lives, everyone around you is coming to know Jesus Christ. So you can examine your own personal choices you make each day. But then you can also examine your life, the effect of your life and the people around you. Of course, we can't force anyone to believe. But these Thessalonians, because they were living their life in such a radically new way, they were impacting the lives of others. They were doing this, what we call the method of the master, that St. Paul spent time with those leaders, and those leaders spent time with others, and through a one-on-one relationship, through a mentoring of sort, everyone's lives was changing. So who in your life knows that you are a Christian? Who in your life wants to be a Catholic because you are Catholic? Because you're living out the fullness of God's revelation. This is the command, what it means to love. If all of this is true and that we're dead without Jesus and we only get Jesus in the sacraments, how many people are we letting die out there because we won't invite them into the one thing, the only thing that will save their life? For they themselves, the people that you're talking to, declare about us and how you turned away from your idols. So can you give your testimony that I used to be this way? Football used to be first in my life. Sports, the economy, social justice, waving the right flag, voting for the right party. That used to be my prominent and dominating force in my life, but now I know Jesus and everything has changed. This is what St. Paul is inviting us to, a radically new way of life. That you turn from your idols and you begin to serve the living and the true God. Not the God that makes your life easy or convenient or comfortable. I mean, that may happen. But he's living and he's true. And this morning he's inviting you into a radically new relationship. One of true love. And as Christians, we don't have to wonder what that is. We simply need to look at the crucifix. So does your love, the love for your spouse, the love for your children and your neighbors, the love for your pastor and your parish, are you embracing the cross and the difficulty and the suffering and the affliction that comes with true love? Are you embracing it with joy? The joy that comes from dying to yourself to live for the Lord. This is when you're ready to truly love your neighbor. And this is how the only way you can truly love your neighbor is if you embrace the cross. Because that's the only way that we know how to love. So when St. John of the Cross says, at the end of your life, you will simply be judged on love alone. If that is true, what will your verdict be?